Leggings are so much more than workout clothes. Great leggings are truly a necessity. But that doesn't mean they should cost a fortune. That's why I'm so glad I found Fabletics, and here's why. For one, I am tall and struggle to find leggings that are long enough. But Fabletics leggings are available in different lengths, from petite to regular to tall, and they have all your sizes covered, from extra extra small to 3X. And Fabletics clothes are designed to move with you. Whether I'm researching or script writing or chasing the kids around the park, they are comfortable and supportive. And not only that, they are super cute too. You honestly could wear them anywhere. They easily take you from the gym to lunch. I signed up as a VIP and it's awesome. You select options regarding your shape, what type of exercise you like to do, and what kind of pattern catches your eye. And it selects the styles and patterns that match your profile. It really is that easy. And since Fabletics release new styles every month, you always have something new to look forward to and to choose from. Honestly, the floral patterns are really cute and I'm always getting compliments when I wear them. I love being a VIP and you will too. Go to fabletics.com/site now to get two pairs of their amazing leggings for just $24. Seriously, they are the world's best leggings. They're a $99 value and you'll get two for only $24. And that's when you join fabletics.com/site. That's fabletics.com/site. In 1961, a housewife and mother of two, 30-year-old Joan Riche, was living with her family in Lincoln, Massachusetts. October 24th should have been just like any other day. Her husband was out of town on business and she had errands to run. But in strange and mysterious circumstances, she goes missing, and to this day, almost 60 years later, she's never been found. But maybe that is exactly the way she wanted it. Hello and welcome to Insight. My name is Ali and here with me is Charlie. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. This week's episode is a listener suggestion. This week's case was suggested to us very early on and by a whole bunch of people. The first two were Alison and Nazim, so thank you. Joan Carolyn Bard was born May 12, 1930 in Brooklyn, New York. Joan had a fairly traumatic childhood. When she was 9 years old, her family moved to New Jersey. And not even a year later, in 1940, when she was still 9 years old, her parents died in what could only be described as a suspicious house fire. The Boston Globe would later report that not long after this happened, Jane told an acquaintance or a friend, it has been reported as both, but she told this person that she had actually been sexually abused as a child. It has been alluded to in what I have read that this sexual abuse was at the hands of a family member. Now, what I've also seen speculated and what was considered for a while was that because Joan was sexually assaulted and because of the house fire and it was deemed suspicious, that she may have actually started the fire to escape from her life. However, when I did some digging into what actually happened at the time, Joan was away staying at her grandmother's at the time of the fire, so there was no way that she could have been responsible.
After her parents died, Joan moved in with her aunt and uncle who would go on to formally adopt her. Joan took their last name, and so she was known as Jonah Trass, and that's the name she'd use until she married and changed her name to her husband's surname. Despite the traumatic start to her life, she ended up spending her later childhood with a pretty happy life and a stable home. After high school, Joan studied English literature at Wilson College in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. Literature was a passion, like a true passion for her, and she spent most of her spare time either reading or writing. Then after she graduated college in 1952, Joan went into the industry that best matched her passion and education. She went into publishing. But she started out pretty much at the bottom. She was a secretary at a publishing company, just a member of the secretarial pool, actually. But because of her interest in books and her talent in writing, and not to mention just her dedication to her job, she was promoted up to first supervising the secretarial pool, and then later she was made an editorial assistant at Harcourt, Brace, and World. Joan was known to just love her job and be extremely dedicated to her work, very career-oriented, and this is going to come up later.
And this is incredibly impressive to me, not only because of the start of life she had with a traumatic childhood, but also for the time we're talking about here. This was the 1950s where education and a job wasn't considered entirely important for women who were supposed to get married, have children, and be a housewife. She was definitely ahead of her time.
In her next position after that first one we just talked about, she became an editorial assistant at a paper company called Thomas White Crowell and Company, and this was in Fitchburg, Massachusetts. And it's here that she met Martin Riesch. He was the executive director at the company, and the pair quickly connected and fell in love and married in 1956.
Joan's life would now take a different turn. After their wedding, they moved to Ridgefield, Connecticut, and within the year, they welcomed a baby girl into the world that they named Lillian. After the birth of Lillian, Joan would quit her job and she took on the role of a housewife, looking after the children and the home. And then in 1959, the Riesches had another child, this time a boy, and his name was David. Unlike other women of her generation, she didn't intend to stay a housewife, though. And this is where Joan's love of reading and writing comes back into play. But she expressed how she wanted to become a teacher once her children were older and in school. She wanted to share her love of literature to the next generation. After David's birth, the family moved again, and in April 1961, they moved to Lincoln, Massachusetts. Here they lived on Old Bedford Road, and by all accounts, they fit in really well. They were popular where they lived, and they were friendly with all the neighbours. The reason for their move to Lincoln was because Martin accepted a position as an executive at the Fitchburg Paper Company. 30-year-old Joan Riesch immediately got involved within the community to keep herself busy by being active with the local groups and community organisations. She was a key member in the League of Women's Voters, and this is basically an organisation that encouraged women to participate in larger roles in public affairs after they won the right to vote. I cannot stress enough how independent and determined Joan was. She would have been a great role model for her children. She was way ahead of her time and didn't buy into the stereotypical gender roles that were normal for the time. But this sense of belonging for Joan meant that she didn't feel lonely and isolated, and she felt like she was contributing. This was because Martin's new job meant he would travel often, mostly interstate, and she spent a lot of time at home alone with the children.
And now we get to where the case begins. If you've never heard of this case before, brace yourself a bit. It's a strange one. All disappearances have questions, but this one had me rereading parts of articles and documents because I was like, what in the world is this? So let's start with the timeline for that day. This happened just a few months after the family had moved to Lincoln, October 24th, 1961. The day started off very normal, almost mundane, but quickly descended into a series of events that have baffled investigators for almost 60 years. Allie is going to post the timeline on our website so you can follow it visually if you get the chance to go out there. We've done this for a couple of episodes, but it's been a while. I think since the Maria Rudolph episode, which was like 45 that we that we've done this, but in this case, it's really important because the timeline is long and we're going to jump back and forth a bit. Our goal is not to confuse anyone. So Allie will get that timeline up when this episode goes live, and that will help you follow it. October 24th started like any weekday morning, like I said, except Martin had a business trip, so he got up early. In his initial statement to police later that day, he said he left the house at 6:50 to drive to Logan Airport, which is in Boston, to catch an 8 a.m. flight to New York City. He said Joan was still in bed when he left, but as far as anyone can tell, Joan got up, the kids got up, they had breakfast, got ready for their day.
So for the next 3 hours, as Charlie said, Joan makes breakfast and then she tidies up. She phoned a friend to chat about their day. As we said, this day was just like any other day. And then she went over to a neighbour who she was friendly with, Barbara Barker's home, and Barbara will become very important to this story. But it was arranged that Barbara would babysit her son David while she went and ran a few errands with her daughter Lillian. Remember, her children were 2 and 4 at this point. Anyone with children would know that doing anything with young children, especially more than one, can take double or triple the time it normally would. And Joan had a full schedule for the day and thought that it would be easier if David stayed with Barbara, and she would regularly watch the children anyway, and Joan would take her eldest child around to run the errands. So Lillian and Joan left in Joan's 1951 blue Chevrolet, and they went to the dentist so Joan could get a cavity filled. She then booked an appointment for the 31st, which was the following week, and she settled the dentist bill, which was $40, and she paid in cash. She went to the W.L. Grant department store, where she bought some pajamas for David, a gift for Martin, and a new bra for herself. Once again, she paid for this in cash. It would be around this time that the milkman and the newspaper delivery both came. Both men would later report to the police that there was nothing out of the ordinary at the house. It just seemed as normally as it would from the outside.
Joan and Lillian then came back home, and Joan obviously went to pick David up from Barbara's. This has been reported as sometime between 10:55 and 11:15. A few of the locals would later confirm this, and they said that Lillian and Joan seemed happy and their usual selves. If pressed, they may have seemed a little tired from the errands, but not like they were unhappy or that anything was wrong or they were alarmed about anything. Then sometime between 11:15 and 11:45, William Kohlberg, who was the local dry cleaner, came by to pick up 2 of Martin's business suits. This was the usual dry cleaner that Martin used, and he would also report that Joan had a habit of leaving the front door unlocked if she knew someone was coming by, whether they were coming to visit or it was a workman or something like this dry cleaner. So Walter was able to just walk right through the front door, have a quick chat with Joan, pick up the suits, and go. This time is set by Walter, by the way. Joan's daughter told authorities that a man came over to pick up clothes, quote, after lunch, not before. So I'm going to guess he came later in the time frame. I'm not sure that's entirely important. He would later be questioned. Did he see anything unusual? Was anything alarming him? But also, he was probably questioned a little bit just because we know he was in the house. So that would be someone you'd want to talk to.
And they would have found his fingerprints and such in the house, so he would have been someone they would have questioned very early on anyway.
And he told investigators he had nothing to report. Everything was in order. The house looked fine. Joan was acting normal, friendly. There was nothing that stood out to him or set off his spidey senses. For the next 2 hours, the schedule runs like clockwork. Joan changed out of her dress clothes that she wore to the dentist into more casual at-home attire, which is kind of funny to me because, like, my at-home attire and my going-out attire have become the same thing. So it's not the 1960s anymore, I guess. But this was a blue house dress that she changed into and a pair of white sneakers. She had lunch with her children, tidied up. So we're talking around noon. She put David in his crib for his usual nap. again, 1960s, most kids were on sleep schedules. That sounds amazing to me right now. And David generally napped from noon to 2 every afternoon. So after David went down for his nap, Barbara Barker from across the street came over with her 4-year-old, Douglas. Douglas and Lillian were the same age, and because the moms swapped babysitting and the kids had playdates together, they got along really well. And Barbara puts this at about 1 p.m. On this occasion, Barbara dropped Douglas off and went back to her own house. Lillian and Douglas went out to play in the driveway of Joan's house while David slept. So all the children were occupied. Joan just tended to what needed to be done, finished up dishes. She did a bunch of yard work. And once this was done, that is the last normal thing that would happen this entire day. And this is when things start getting strange.
When Joan finished tending to the garden at about 2 p.m., she walked Lillian and Douglas down the 60-foot driveway and walked them back over to Barbara's house without telling Barbara. She had no idea that the children were back in her yard. Joan left the two children on the swing set in the Barker's backyard. When Joan left the children at the swing set, she told Lillian that she would be back soon, but she never returned, walking back to her house alone. From here, the two children could not see the Riche house, so they had no idea what happened next. And what we will see in this case from here on, though, there is a lot of time that is unaccounted for, or we have a speculation as to what happened next in Joan's day, or life for that matter. There is little over an hour of time where no one sees anything out of the ordinary at the Riche family home. 15 minutes later, at about 2:15 p.m, Barbara is in her kitchen. And this kitchen has an obstructed view to Joan's house. There are a few trees blocking, but there is still some view to the Riche home. But Barbara is in her kitchen and she looked out her window, and what she saw was Barbara in a trench coat and her arms were outstretched holding a red unidentified object. She seems to be in a hurry, moving from her car and up her driveway towards the garage. As we said before, at the time Barbara had no idea that the children were in her backyard, and it seemed like nothing was out of the ordinary. She just assumed that Joan was playing with the children, and because her view was obstructed, for all she knew, the children were there and playing a chasing game or something like that. And this was the last confirmed sighting of Joan. I do say confirmed because we will get to a whole heap of unconfirmed sightings.
So let's get into some of those sightings. Around 2:45 p.m., an eyewitness would later report that she saw someone wearing the same clothes or similar clothes that Joan was described to be wearing at the time of her disappearance. And this person, alleged to possibly be Joan, was standing along Route 2A. According to the eyewitness sighting, she was just wandering aimlessly. She was hunched over as if she was cold, even though she was wearing a trench coat. And you know that pose, her arms crossed over her torso, shoulders hunched. It was only 45 degrees, which is about 7.5 degrees Celsius. So it's not like it was an 80 degree day. Being cold would make sense, even with a coat on. The eyewitness also described this woman, possibly Joan, as looking untidy. Between 3 and 3:15 p.m., another eyewitness spotted a woman, this time on Route 128. I looked at the map and I noticed that 2A and 128 intersect, but I'm not entirely sure how far apart these sightings really would have been. So it's a little hard for us to map it with the timing when we don't know exactly where on these highways she was seen. Regardless, this woman again matched Joan's description, also wearing a coat. She was said to be hunched over and either clutching something near her stomach or clutching her actual stomach. This sighting, there was blood running down both the front of her and down both legs. And now we're going to have a third eyewitness who would later report seeing the same woman around 4:30 p.m., still on Route 128 this time. So this would have been an hour and a half, hour and 15 minutes later. She was near a construction site. They were actually doing quite a bit of construction on that road at the time, and she was really close to a spot they were excavating. She had what was described as brownish-red splotches of mud on her legs, but of course, what else is brownish-red? Dried blood. She was hunched over a bit, but her hands were reportedly in her pockets. Despite this and these sightings, no one stopped to help the woman, and the sightings of her stopped at this point.
We just need to take a quick break for a word about one of our sponsors this week, Away.
I travel a lot, and recently I was working on the plane, reading on my phone, doing some research, and when I got to my layover, I needed to charge my phone. All of the charging stations in the airport were crowded, people just crammed in there, but I saw this man with an Away carry-on bag, and he had his charger going to his carry-on bag. He was actually charging his phone using his carry-on, and so I knew I had to have one. More than just the ability to charge my phone with that battery pack, I love the features of Away luggage. No more sticky wheels. All four wheels spin 360. It is incredibly lightweight, and I tend to be an overpacker, and the Away has patent-pending compression system. When I travel to Toronto this summer, I'm going to have to take pictures of everything I can fit into this one piece of luggage because you are just not going to believe it. Away offers a lifetime guarantee. If it breaks, they will fix it. And they offer a 100-day trial. Try it out. If you decide it's not for you, return it for a full refund. Or alternately, you could just give it to me because I would gladly take it. My birthday is in April. You can order at awaytravel.com with free shipping to the lower 48 or stop by their retail store in New York. That's awaytravel.com.
So we're going to jump back in time a bit at around 3 p.m. The daughter of one of the neighbours of the Riche family, Virginia Keane, she would later report that when she was getting off the school bus, she noticed an unfamiliar car in the driveway of the Riche family home. She would describe the car as being a dirty, two-toned blue and beige sedan. Another 5 minutes after this, another neighbour would later report that they had to stop to let an unfamiliar car, again a two-tone sedan, they had to let them out of either the Keane or the Riche family driveway. When they were interviewed by investigators, Virginia and her mother were both adamant that there was no car in their driveway at this time. Interestingly, the milkman would later report seeing a car matching this description 5 days earlier. Another neighbour of the Riche family said that they saw a car matching this description at around 4:15 on Route 2A. And if we haven't mentioned this before, Route 2A was off Old Bedford Road where the Riche family lived.
It would be around 4 p.m. that Barbara would notice that the children were at her house, and she actually had some errands to run. She had to go do her grocery shopping, so she returned Lillian to her home in the driveway, assuming Joan was inside with the little one. The door's always left unlocked. So she let Lillian go back inside herself and headed off to the grocery store. Lillian would have been completely capable of opening that door. She was four. When Barbara returned home about a half hour later, Lillian was outside and she was upset, saying that her mommy was gone and the house was covered. Either the house or the kitchen, I've seen it reported both ways, was covered in red paint. Sensing something was not right, Barbara went into the Riche residence, leaving Lillian and Douglas outside. She immediately saw in the kitchen that what Lillian said was true, except what Lillian thought was paint wasn't. It was actually blood. The blood was smeared all over the walls and the floors of the kitchen. Barbara could also hear David crying from his crib. He had been in there since noon, and it was now 4:30. So who knows how long he was in there awake, with a dirty diaper, hungry, crying for his mom. On her way to David's bedroom to get him, Barbara realized that the blood was not just in the kitchen. There were streaks of it kind of trailing up the stairs and into the master bedroom. Barbara wouldn't waste any more time in the house, though. She just got David, and at 4:33 p.m., she notified the police.
And I understand her wanting to get out of the house. She didn't know who was still in the house, if there wasn't an attacker in there. I'm not surprised she grabbed David and got out. The police would arrive within 5 minutes. From the scene that was described over the phone, the police assumed they were going to process a suicide and they anticipated on finding Joan's body fairly quickly. Now, of course, when they arrived to the Riche family home, Joan was nowhere to be found. The first thing they noticed was how unusual the scene looked. It would later be estimated there would be about a pint of blood throughout the house. Not enough to kill someone, but enough to mean that they would be suffering the effects of blood loss. It was obvious that someone had tried to clean up the blood with some paper towels and some of David's clothing. They traced the blood from the kitchen up to the master bedroom and then back out to the driveway. The blood would be found on both the hood and the trunk of Joan's car. From the driveway, the trail mysteriously stopped, and it's not clear where the trail of blood began and where it actually ended. Investigators believed the trail ended in the driveway, where she was possibly forced into a car by someone. Back to the scene in the kitchen, there was a table that was overturned, and the weirdest part was that the phone that was normally wall-mounted was actually ripped from the wall and put in the bin. And this bin was normally kept underneath the sink, but instead it was in the middle of the kitchen. There was also a phone book found near the phone, and it was open to the emergency services page. And what I could gather from my research, this was kind of like a homemade phone book. I know my grandmother used to have this kind of book where she would keep friends and family's phone numbers in, as well as any doctors, dentists, emergency services. This is what this phone book sounds like to me. And keep in mind, this was before 911 was implemented, so they had to have an emergency contacts page. But, and this is why I believe it was a homemade phone book, but in this phone book, the emergency contact page was left blank. There was no phone numbers in it. It was thought at this point, based on the kitchen, that perhaps Joan had an emergency. Maybe she hurt herself accidentally or had an unexplained hemorrhage, an injury that she had tried to seek help for.
The problem with the theory that this was an accident and Joan was the only one there is that there was blood smeared on the kitchen wall, and they found two prints on the wall, prints from what might be a right hand, but they weren't sure, and a palm print that appears to be from a right hand. On the telephone, they found a partial print that is often reported as a thumbprint, but in the documents I found from the time, it says they're unsure which finger it was, which makes sense because it was an isolated partial print that would be hard to identify which finger. And you all know how much we love inconsistent reporting, and I have a little bit more of it for you. Some sources say the prints were not Joan's. If true, this showed someone else was absolutely present at the time of the attack. But other sources, including an article from early 1962, which was just months after she went missing, said they weren't able to rule out Joan because they never had her prints on file to compare. But then I found a missing persons flyer from shortly after that article was published, where they did have her thumbprint on file from the hospital records. And I think this might be where thumbprint gets put into the narrative on that partial print. But it even said on this flyer that they weren't sure if this was her left or her right thumb. So what we're talking about here is matching a thumbprint from one hand, not sure which, to a partial fingerprint that might be a thumb, but might be something else. But let's say they had a complete print on the telephone and Joan's complete fingerprint card. Best circumstances possible, and I still don't know if we can say 100%. You know how much I love forensics, so here we go. I was talking to Dominique, the host of Death Store podcast, on the phone last week, and she said something about fingerprints that was interesting. I said something about fingerprints that was favorable towards them in a court case, and she said, you know those aren't 100%, right? And I was like, no, I had no idea, so I looked it up. And I'm happy that I can use this new knowledge right now. There's this independent organization that gives an annual test. It's entirely voluntary, and it's on fingerprint analysis. They send out side-by-side prints to these examiners, and all the examiner has to do is say yes or no. They don't have to match them blindly like a matching game. They just have to examine the prints next to each other and say yes, they match, or no, they don't. They get 8 to 12 of these pairs. And these are complete prints, not partials. the error rate is anywhere from 3% to 20%. And 20% is a huge error rate. And we know now in 2018 that there have been wrongful convictions that included fingerprint evidence. So fingerprint analysis is not infallible. So to that end, I'm not personally convinced that they could absolutely include or exclude Joan from being the source of this partial print. I don't know what you thought about that, Allie.
It is difficult. I mean, I guess they could look at other people who would have been in and out of the house, other fingerprints, and maybe it matched the most closely to Joan. But as you said, it's not an exact science, especially back in the 1960s. It would be even less so. Maybe they were reaching, maybe they were, she was the closest one. That's all I can come back to.
Yeah, so I don't know that they could include or exclude. So to me, I know this is like very compelling when I first read it. And had I not talked to Dominique last week, I would have been like sold, because I really did have this perception that fingerprints was pretty much a pretty good deal. But the science, there's a lot more out there about the science of fingerprints. If anyone wants to talk to me in the group about it, I'll not go too far into it here. And let's get back to the let's get back on track. A week after Joan's disappearance, the authorities sent a letter to the FBI, and in it they stated that they were unsure the cause of the incident. They said there was no evidence of an abduction, and they felt it was still possible that this was self-inflicted, accidental, or, quote, some type of hemorrhage. They also put forward the idea that mental illness could be at play, but they admitted that Joan had no history of mental illness. But eventually, investigators would take the evidence and possibly their belief that the prints came from someone else and the eyewitnesses, and eventually changed the course of the investigation to focus on foul play. And the search for Joan began in a very big way. As the hours passed, 50 police officers, military personnel, helicopters, off-duty FBI agents were deployed in Massachusetts into the woods and the waterways, and even into neighboring suburbs. There was a reservoir in particular that was searched, but it turned up no signs of Joan, not even a scrap of clothing. Investigators contacted all the local hospitals to check to see if any woman matching her description or possibly wearing a coat like the eyewitnesses saw that woman wearing the day of Joan's disappearance, if any of those people had shown up at the hospital, but no one had. Martin had originally planned on staying in New York overnight on this business trip, but obviously he returned home immediately upon hearing the news that his wife had vanished. Not only vanished, but she could have been gravely injured and gone. He was understandably shocked by what investigators were telling him. I mean, the children were fine, but his wife had been abducted, possibly the victim of foul play. Whatever it was not good. But as the day passed and there was no trace of Joan, the investigators had really no option but to just focus on the crime scene.
The blood at the crime scene was sampled, and it was a match to Joan's blood type, type O. But due to the limitations in forensic testing back in the 1960s, they couldn't conclusively say that it was definitely Joan's blood work. At the crime scene, there was no other blood or footprints throughout the blood. The attacker would have been very careful not to step in the blood, or was very lucky not to leave any footprints behind. Investigators were baffled where to start, though. They still had more questions than answers. Whose prints was on the wall, and most importantly, where was Joan, and what exactly went wrong here? Joan had a happy marriage from all accounts. She had no enemies and was known for being a loving and devoted mother who would have done anything to protect her children. Keep that in mind as we go further into the suspects and theories surrounding Joan's disappearance. It's clear to understand why this case is beyond strange.
The investigator started compiling a list of possible suspects if something did happen to Joan from an outside source, and they were aware they were losing time here. So the first, of course, was Martin, which is just natural. He was the closest to his wife, the most obvious suspect. Intimate partner violence is a major issue, but he was quickly cleared due to his alibi of being in New York, and that was completely backed up. He maintained that he and Joan had a happy marriage, and neighbors, family, friends all backed him up on that. So then they talked to the three other people they knew would have been at the house that day, the mailman, the milkman, and the dry cleaner. But all of these led to dead ends, and all of these people were eventually cleared from suspicion.
There were two more notable suspects, and one of these was Robert Foster. Robert Foster worked for the National Park Service, and what the National Park Service was trying to do at the time was create a national park called the Minuteman National Historical Park. They wanted to acquire some of the houses in the area to build this park, and one of the houses was the Reisch family home. He spoke with Joan and a few of her neighbours on September 25 about the value of their homes. Now, all the neighbours were later interviewed and they said he was a bit pushy and he overstayed his welcome when clearly no one wanted to give up their homes. Joan knew of the proposed national park as it was a topic of discussion at the League of Women's Voters meetings. But this lead was eventually dismissed because he did have an ironclad alibi, which was confirmed by his co-worker, and he wasn't questioned any further.
The next suspect came to investigators' attention when they were trying to find the owner of that two-toned sedan that the eyewitnesses had seen near the family home on the day of Joan's disappearance. The investigators managed to trace a car back to a man named Harold Munder, and he was an outpatient from a hospital in Bedford, and Bedford is just north of Lincoln. He was seen by eyewitnesses at 4:15 exiting his car, again, this two-toned sedan, on Route 2A, so we know he was in the area. One of the oddities here is that Munder got out of his car on Route 2A, he walked into the woods, cut a few branches off the tree, and then put them in his car and drove away. Around 6 hours after this happened, so we're saying about 10 p.m., a cab company contacted the police to report Munder as acting suspiciously. He was allegedly sending a telegram to his brother, but for some reason, while he was doing it, he was just acting off. And I couldn't find exactly what he was doing that were setting off alarm bells, but this lead was eventually dismissed. He was cleared of any involvement, despite the fact his car matched the description of the one seen in the locations where Joan had been seen. It very well could just be a coincidence. These could be two completely different, unrelated cars. It's not like two-toned cars were rare at this point in time. No one who saw the car knew the owner of it, so we have a car that ultimately leads us nowhere.
And then the case went cold. That was until 2 years later, a local reporter for the local Lincoln newspaper, The Fence Viewer, he became interested in the case and started digging. Serene Greeson went to the local library, where he came across some interesting information. And despite having no new leads coming from this, it almost made the case more confusing and created even more questions for investigators. What Serene discovered was that a few months before Joan's disappearance, she had checked out 25 books from the library. But she loved books, so there is nothing strange about that, right? Well, you would be wrong. Every single one of these books would be related to crime and mystery. In particular, they were related to murders and disappearances. Now, we would be the last people to say this is weird because I imagine that both mine and Charlie's library borrowing histories would be very similar to Joan's. But the thing is that they were not only books related to murder and disappearances, but they were about people who were trying to disappear on their own or staging a murder so they could disappear. These books included stories about an orphan girl vanishing, a man staging his own disappearance, a wife vanishing without a trace, a teenager staging his own disappearance, and there was one book in particular, and this book was called Into Thin Air, which Joan checked out in September before she disappeared. This book would prove very similar to her circumstances. It was about a woman who disappeared from her home, and the only evidence in her home was some blood-smeared towels. Despite how eerily similar this was and how much coincidence she just happened to check these books out a few months before she disappeared, there was no new leads that came from it.
Her husband didn't find anything odd about his wife's library borrowing history, though. He said she simply loved a good suspense story, but the press didn't see it that way, and the story kind of took on a life of its own. I think a little bit of it had to do with the fact that she was known for liking literature and high lit type stuff. And then here she is right before she disappears, devouring thrillers and books about people disappearing or murders and that kind of thing. But I'm someone who reads high lit and true crime at the same time, so to me it doesn't seem that odd. No new theories came from this, like Allie said, or have come in the last 60 years. So there are many questions about this case, and there are just as many theories to match it.
We just need to take a quick break for a word about one of our sponsors this week, Purple.
I spend a lot of time in a chair. I'm always working, whether it's downstairs in my office or upstairs in the family room, and I have a Purple cushion. It gives my back more support. It makes those long hours sitting not so hard on my body. But Purple is best known for their mattresses. The way you feel after you get a good night's sleep is just so different than when you've been tossing and turning because of pain or discomfort. The Purple mattress will feel different than anything you've ever experienced. They use a brand new material. It was designed by an actual rocket scientist, so it's not like memory foam I'm used to. The Purple material is both firm and soft at the same time. Everything stays supported while still feeling comfortable. It's breathable too, so it sleeps cool, which is very important to me. It ends up giving you this zero gravity-like feel, so it's going to work regardless of your sleeping position. They offer a risk-free trial for 100 nights, and if you're not fully satisfied, you can return your mattress for a full refund. It's backed by a 10-year warranty with free shipping and returns. They'll even do a free in-home setup and take away your old mattress. You're going to love Purple. And right now, my listeners will get free sheets and a free mattress protector with your mattress purchase. Just go to purple.com/insight. That's purple.com/insight. purple.com/insight. The first theory that we're going to talk about, and investigators' main line of investigation eventually, was that Joan was kidnapped by Robert Foster or Harold Munder or someone else. And then later, she was murdered. Because Joan left her house unlocked, and this was well known in the neighborhood, it would have been easy for pretty much anyone to gain entry. She was injured, possibly in a struggle in her home, and then forced into the car, which would support why the blood trail just suddenly stopped at the end of the driveway. It would also explain the two-toned car, but it also leaves a lot unexplained, such as the eyewitness sightings.
An alternative theory to this, which goes along a similar path, was that she was attacked and not kidnapped. And this starts the same with her attacker entering the house and attacking her and the injury being so severe, causing her to bleed, which would have caused some sort of amnesia. She may have been able to escape for a short while, or maybe because the blood trail ended at the driveway was because that's where she was attacked. This would explain the later possible sightings of Joan along Route 2A and Route 128. It's possible that the attacker left or caught up with her at some point and then abducted her along the highway, finishing the job and then hiding her body. Now, no one reported anyone following her, but then again, no one stopped to help her either. And we don't know the why and the who in this scenario since there's no confirmed suspect here.
The next theory is one that investigators originally considered, and that's that Joan harmed herself, or there was a medical emergency where she accidentally hurt herself. This severe loss of blood would have left her disoriented, in shock, or once again suffering the effects of amnesia. Then in this confused, disoriented state, she was walking to find help but didn't know where to go. Again, this would explain why she was spotted on the nearby highways, seemingly just wandering. But while she was in this state and losing a lot of blood, Maybe she went into the construction site that she was spotted near. She fell into a hole unconscious. This is kind of, we talked about another case where somebody may have been in a construction site and it's the same thing. The construction workers not seeing her simply filled back in over her body. Some like this dramatic long-term amnesia theory where Joan ends up living happily ever after somewhere else without a clue who she is, but that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me because she'd probably have gone to the hospital or some strange woman would show up and be confused and someone would report it. But this theory of her injuring herself and leaving, it leaves out the two-toned car, which again, we don't know whether or not it's connected. It also leaves out the unidentified thumb and palm prints that may not have been hers that were left at the scene. So not all of the pieces fit, but again, because we don't know what happened, we don't know what pieces are red herrings, so to speak.
Something I just thought of, the Riche family home was close to the construction site. The fact that the two-toned car was only around or seen around for a short period of time, it may have been a construction worker, which would explain why the car was dirty. It mightn't be something nefarious. Another theory along these lines is that she suffered from a mental break. This again, while explaining some of the sightings, doesn't explain why the car and the prints were there. Additionally, there was no history of mental illness with her or her family. And while that doesn't discount that she could have been suffering from a mental illness of some kind, the fact that she was very active in the community, the fact that she was around people a lot of the time, and the fact that her family and friends never reported that Joan had a mental illness makes me believe that she didn't. And if she did, it would have been a very quick onset of one. It's not impossible, but extremely unlikely to me. And again, this theory doesn't explain the unidentified bloodied prints on the walls and the trail ending at the driveway. It's possible that she had stopped or slowed the bleeding by this point. She was obviously able to walk some distance away from home with the bleeding, so it is possible she had stopped it at some point.
So now this is where the theories take a turn for the sinister and the strange. The New England Untold Stories Group researched this case and extensively interviewed those who knew Joan. They compiled some original documents, which I've referred to a few of them in this episode. They determined that they believed that Joan was murdered and someone connected to William Barker, possibly hired by him. And if you're wondering why that surname sounds familiar, it's because we said it in this episode repeatedly in relation to his wife, Barbara. William and Barbara were the neighbors across the street who swapped child minding duties. Under this theory, Joan was buried in a vacant lot just 10 minutes away in Lexington that was owned by the Barkers. A month after Joan went missing, the Barkers submitted plans to build on the lot, which happened, and from what I can tell, nobody's excavated it. There are some gaps in this, like a motive for starters. Was William searching the house for something and Joan walked in? Did he have a grudge against the family? We don't know. And what links him and his property to Joan? We also don't know. And none of this information is given on how we got from point A to point B here. Second, the Barkers' involvement, whether William alone or with his wife, it doesn't come up in any other source I could find, and I looked. This is the only source giving this theory, and they're not giving a whole lot to back it up.
The next theory is even stranger and purely based on speculation, that Joan was having an affair and the owner of the two-tone sedan was her lover to assist with an abortion. And there's actually a few theories within this one. Now, it's important to note that at this time, abortion was illegal. And of course, whenever you make something illegal, there is going to be some questionable doctors who are still willing to carry these procedures out for a price. And what we saw with the theories in the case we covered back in episode 27, the Indiana Sand Dunes 3, these procedures aren't always done safely and can prove extremely dangerous, even life-threatening. And in this situation, if something did go wrong, the doctor would dispose of the body out of fear of losing their medical license, and they are risking being charged for carrying out an illegal abortion as well as manslaughter. There are a lot of ways this theory could go. The first is that Joan was pregnant with a baby that was not Martin's, and this baby was a result of an affair. This seems unlikely to me for multiple reasons. Firstly, they had only just moved there, and it would be unlikely that she'd met someone and started an affair that quickly. And secondly, she had two children who were at home with her and with her all the time. They didn't have a nanny, and if she wanted to go anywhere, she had to ask Barbara Barker to watch the children, so she didn't get a lot of time by herself. If her lover visited her at the home, not only would the neighbours have noticed this strange car in the driveway and a strange man in the area, but at 4 years old, her daughter was old enough to articulate that there was a man in the house. But this theory goes that she was pregnant to a man that she was having an affair with. She made arrangements for a doctor to come and abort that baby so that her husband wouldn't find out, and it went wrong. She started hemorrhaging, and then the doctor disposed of the body.
The second theory within this theory is that she was pregnant with Martin's child, but for whatever reason, she didn't want to have the baby, or she didn't want Martin to find out about the baby. He said that if she was pregnant, she would have been happy about it, but I mean, does he really know that? As we said earlier, she was wanting to become a teacher. She had been a career woman before, so she wanted to become a teacher when her children went to school. If she had another baby, she would prolong this by another couple years. But, you know, really, whatever the reason is, she didn't want to have a third child and didn't want her husband to know she was pregnant, so she waited till he went on a business trip and arranged a doctor to give her an abortion in her house, which would be the reason she dropped Lillian and Douglas back at the Barker house. And she did this without telling Barbara because what was she going to say, right? So she didn't want Barbara to find out, and she wouldn't want anyone to find out and risk it getting back to Martin. The doctor arrived in a two-tone sedan. They go to perform the abortion in the bedroom where there was some blood found, but the procedure went wrong. They headed downstairs to get some water or whatever reason because she was losing blood and feeling lightheaded. The bleeding got worse and they were panicking. Joan wants to call emergency services. I mean, she's scared, she's bleeding, she's hemorrhaging possibly, doesn't want to die, and the doctor doesn't want her to call. What they did was illegal. He would get in a whole lot of trouble, so he ripped the phone out of the wall to stop her from calling for an ambulance, and he throws it in the bin. Then either he has a change of heart, which would explain the phone book being open to the page number, or maybe she opened it not realizing there weren't going to be numbers there. The biggest flaw in this theory is doctors performing abortions generally didn't make house calls like this, and she just dropped her daughter off across the street. Did she really think in 20 minutes she was going to feel better and just pop over and get her? I don't really feel like this theory makes a whole lot of sense in that regard. There is a third theory that goes down the pregnancy line. It's that Joan was pregnant and either she didn't know or she just hadn't told Martin yet, and she started to have a miscarriage. And in the miscarriage, she had a hemorrhage. She went to try to get help, but lost too much blood, became disoriented. You know the rest. It's all in line with what we've already talked about. The issue with the miscarriage, in my view, is that the car in the driveway, but I mean, that could be entirely unrelated, but the blood did stop at the driveway. I saw the crime scene photos, and I'm just going to say, I don't think there was enough blood for some kind of uncontrolled hemorrhage. And from the police descriptions of the crime scene, it doesn't sound to me like there was. But I do have a question on this because I honestly think the police could have been able to tell if this was blood from an abortion or a miscarriage in the 1960s. I mean, we're not talking the Stone Ages. The endometrium, which is the blood and tissue that lines the uterus, looks different under a microscope than vascular blood looks. So if there was endometrial blood present, they would have been able to tell. They may have been able to tell, but they're not saying because they don't want to comment on details, or it was endometrial blood and they don't want to embarrass the family. But it's, I guess maybe it's possible they didn't look at any of the blood under a microscope. they typed it, so I would think they would have. But I know this theory comes out later. This doesn't seem like it was a police theory.
I would assume that they did look into what type of blood it was, considering they, as you said, they did check the blood type, and they were originally thinking that she may have injured herself but then changed to it being foul play. So I am assuming based on that, they did check.
Yeah, so I think the science, of course, we don't know for sure, but I think this theory is fairly unlikely. I think there would have been different clues left.
The next theory comes from the books Joan borrowed from the library, and that was that she was unhappy with her life and she staged her own disappearance and went off to chase her dreams with a new identity. Because Joan knew almost everyone in her new hometown, there were a few different accounts of what she was like. Some people would say that she was family orientated and very much in love with her husband and children, that she was a devoted housewife. But then there are other accounts that said that she was an ambitious woman and unfulfilled with being a housewife and wanted to do bigger things. She wanted to be a teacher or something to do with literature. And that would further the rumours with what happened in her childhood, that the fire that killed her parents and the sexual abuse, these further fueled this theory. In 1961, you needed actual proof of infidelity or spousal abuse to obtain a divorce. So instead, she thoroughly researches disappearances and extensively plans her own. She stages the crime scene to throw off investigators. It's possible that Joan simply no longer wanted the life that she was living. She staged her disappearance based on what she read in the books like Into Thin Air, and she left to start a new life. If this is indeed what she did, then she succeeded. Joan Riche has never been seen again, living or not.
The disappeared theory is difficult for me to think she would have left her little boy in a crib just for however long it took for someone to notice. You know, I would almost think she would have said, oh, hey, can you watch both of my kids? And then disappeared, you know? But obviously, people do this. I mean, I can't say, I don't know her, but like the mom in me wants to believe another mother wouldn't have done that. The final theory, we've kind of saved maybe my personal one for last here. This involves an intruder entering the Riche residence through the door that Joan always kept unlocked. So whatever the intention of this intruder, they were upstairs when Joan arrived back home. The intruder tried to leave undetected, but they couldn't because there was no back door in this house. There were only two ways in and out, and that was either through the garage or back out the front door. So either way, it would have gone right back into that front yard. It wouldn't be possible to leave without being seen, so the intruder remained upstairs while Joan went about her day. While outside with Lillian and Douglas, Joan saw something moving in the upstairs window, or, I don't know, maternal intuition kicked in, and she sensed that there was something wrong in the house, and because David was in the house, she knew he wasn't safe. So to be on the safe side, she took Lillian and Douglas over to the neighbor's home, where she knew they would just kind of play on the swing set for a little while, where she could go check the house, put her wild imagination to rest. And so she told Lillian she's not going to be long, she'll be right back. So she went home, and her plan was to do a quick search. In the meantime, the intruder had seen that Joan left the yard and maybe saw that as his chance to get out, but he bumped into Joan, possibly in the kitchen. There was a struggle. The intruder flees. Joan gets away. Or alternately, the intruder doesn't flee, but rather abducts Joan and somehow ends up on the side of the road if those witnesses are accurate. But if that is the case, I mean, we still have all the same questions in the end. Who was the intruder? What about the car? It's not like the intruder would have parked his car in front where Joan could see it, and it wasn't there when Joan arrived.
I guess the main thing we need to look at here is if Joan was murdered, then where is the body? Those who subscribe to the assault or the intruder theory believe that her killer hid her remains very well, maybe in the construction site. And again, those who believe that Joan was disorientated and had amnesia believe that her body is somewhere in that construction site. If Joan is alive, maybe she still has amnesia and doesn't even know who she is. Or maybe she's just really good at disappearing. I guess the last question we have to ask ourselves is why? Why did this happen? Sadly, I don't think we'll ever know what happened to Joan. I don't think we'll ever know the answers to any of these questions.
My personal opinion on this is that Joan was injured by another party. Now, it could have been an accident or some kind of unintended consequence. Joan went to call for emergency services. The other person panicked. They ripped out the phone. Maybe they pulled her into the car or they lured her by apologizing and saying they were going to drive her right to the hospital. Her husband said that she would invite any salesperson who came to the door in. She was kind of a pushover in that way. And if they stayed there talking too long, she would just let them stay. She wouldn't kind of push them out the door. I mean, when I open my door to solicitors, my face says, stop talking. I don't invite them in and I act very impatient because I am. She wasn't like that. She would have let them in. So maybe it's someone not known to her. And they said they'll drive her to the hospital or whatever. The blood found in other parts of the house may have been Joan trying to get to David before being led or dragged out of the house. Maybe she was in a daze. I do have a hard time dismissing 3 sightings of the woman. But on the other hand, how come none of them stopped? And no one else saw this woman who was out there for, by this time frame, 1.5 hours, 2 hours just roaming. No one else saw her, didn't report it. Then I was looking at the walk she would have had to take, and it didn't seem like an easy walk. This is not a flat neighborhood. It was very hilly, and it would have been a couple of miles while she was bleeding or disoriented. She didn't collapse. She wasn't seen leaving the neighborhood by anyone who knows her. The only other scenario I can think of is that the person who was driving her away in the car had second thoughts and kind of dumped her out of the car, and that's why she was roaming. I mean, otherwise, the roaming doesn't make sense to me. Her walking out of her neighborhood on this terrain while bleeding just doesn't make a whole lot, and nobody saw her, doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
I'm in 2 minds with these unconfirmed sightings too. The fact that at least 3 people saw the exact same person makes me believe that they did see her, but I don't know, we're talking about the 1960s here, I would assume that people, they'd be more likely to stop and ask her, does she need help or take her to the hospital? I know we're talking now 2018, and for safety reasons, I think that most of us would like to believe we would stop, but we probably wouldn't. But I'd like to believe that I'd at least call the police and get someone to help her, but no one did anything. There's a woman bleeding, walking, and no one stopped, and only 3 people on a busy, 2 busy highways, no one else saw her.
It makes me wonder if the woman was just someone else entirely, and maybe the reason other people didn't stop is she was a known person who roamed and was kind of a maybe homeless, and so nobody else did stop, and these 3 people just happened to not be from the area, and so they were like, wow, that's odd. So they reported it. I don't know. The sightings are what really, I feel like this case would be so much easier if these 3 sightings, we could just kick it out. I think the answer's obvious, but these 3 sightings really hold up the logic in this case.
Based on the fact the blood trail stopped at the driveway, I don't think she walked by herself to the highway. It doesn't make sense. So either someone drove her and just dumped her and then whatever happened, or these unconfirmed sightings are just people thinking they saw someone or misremembering. Now, the sightings would continue to come in over the years. People would contact investigators claiming that they had spotted Joan, and they were all followed up, but they all resulted in being a case of misidentification. Martin Riche and their 2 children, Lillian and David, went on to live normal lives. Martin always tried to find Joan because he always believed that Joan was still alive but had amnesia. He never changed his home phone number until the day he died, just in case she regained her memory and wanted to come home. He never remarried and always believed in his heart that Joan was out there somewhere and she would come home one day. Sadly, Martin Riche died in 2009 with no answers as to what happened to his wife.
Thank you for listening. You can find us on Facebook at Insight Podcast, Twitter at Insightful Pod, Instagram at Insight Pod, or email us at insightfulpod@gmail.com. You can also support the show at patreon.com/insightpod. And a special thank you to Chesgrave Music for our new custom theme.